But that, they're still waiting. Right, have a little AV issue. We'll be there in just a second. All right, Committee on Health and Human Services will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so when we do have 13 folks, we will go ahead and officially call the meeting to order. But until we do, we will go ahead and begin our budget presentation. We will begin. We're going to be talking with Minsher today and also with Minnit, and we're going to begin with Scott Peterson, Chief Business Technology Officer with Minnit. We do now have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and officially call the meeting to order. And Mr. Peterson, why don't you go ahead and start your presentation whenever, and you can refer to that in folks' packet.
Mr. Chair, as you said, my name is Scott Peterson, the Chief Business Technology for Minsher. As many of you know, METS is the eligibility system for both Minsher, or the Qualified Health Plan population, as well as the public program population that DHS serves, that includes both the medical assistance and Minnesota Care population. The system currently is used by over 4,000 caseworkers, 2,500 assisters, over 1,000 agency staff and administrators, and more than 870,000 individuals as of November of 2016. We at Minnit are the agency that oversees the vendor contracts as well as the management of the portfolio of projects that are underway. The two core vendors still remaining on site since the start of the exchange back in 2013 are IBM, who is responsible for the eligibility portion of the application, as well as PricewaterhouseCooper, who is still here and engaged heavily on the security portion of the application. We at Minnit work directly with those vendors, as well as the agency partners to prioritize. We provide development services, again, as I said earlier, as well as the project management staff, business analysis, and coordinate with the business directly. We listen closely to the needs of the business partners, including DHS, Minsher, and the counties, and use our technical expertise to put that work in the IT context. We look forward to continuing to work with our partners on the overall IT governance and improvements of the METS system. And I believe Ms. O'Toole want to make an opening statement, if that would be, Mr. Chair.
Hey, welcome to the committee, Ms. O'Toole. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Allison O'Toole. I'm the CEO of Minsher. I'll do a very brief statement and give you a little bit of an update on where we are today. As you know, we recently concluded a very successful formal open enrollment period. We're currently in a special enrollment period, and more on that in just a minute. Minsher has enrolled over 106,000 Minnesotans into private health coverage. Achieving over 100,000 is a milestone for us. Last year, we ended up at about 85,000. So we're well ahead of where we were last year and ahead of our projections this year. 62% of this year's private plan enrollees are receiving federal tax credits, and the average tax credit has tripled. This year, tax credits are averaging more than $600 a month, or about $7,500 a year. Minnesotans are poised to save approximately $350 million in tax credits this year. The remainder, as you all know, will receive a state discount of 25% off their premiums due to recently enacted legislation. That relief averages about $130 a month, or about $1,500 a year. And the good news is that everyone on the individual market this year at this point will save money on their premiums. We've also seen a great uptick in our small group SHOP enrollment. Compared to this time last year, employer enrollment has grown by 65%. This also means that we're covering 700 new employees and about 1,000 new total SHOP enrollees. That includes dependents. We've enrolled nearly 20,000 new Minnesota Care recipients and over 65,000 new medical assistance recipients. And so all of this enrollment activity is a good sign. As I mentioned earlier, we're in the midst of a special enrollment period right now, and that runs for another 36 hours. And that was set up by MNsure following the enactment of the premium relief legislation, and was designed to give Minnesotans a little more time to make that decision. I'm pleased that as a state-based marketplace, we have the flexibility to do that based on our own state needs. On 1095s, I'm pleased to report that MNsure has mailed all of the 1095A forms this year. This is a major undertaking, and we know performance last year was unacceptable. We've worked hard over the past year, both on the IT side with Scott and his team, and on the MNsure side, and we delivered. So thanks to all of our partners for their help on that. One other thing I want to mention before I get to the budget is our request for information, or RFI process, that is underway. Many legislators, actually led by Senator Benson, expressed interest during the task force meetings last year on MNsure pursuing a request for information, which is an RFI, to see what possible technology options are out there for us. The responses to the RFI have been shared with the contracts work group of the Executive Steering Committee, on which I sit. And this work group is evaluating those responses and will make a recommendation to the full Executive Steering Committee soon. I'll also be getting direction from the MNsure board on that. The responses are public, and I'd be happy to share those to the extent anyone is interested in reading those. There's some interesting options out there. We're also exploring functionality for SHOP and how we can better serve Minnesota businesses. And these options will include functionality both through the MET system and some options outside the MET system. So we will work accordingly with the Executive Steering Committee and our board on those, and I'm happy to share that information as it becomes available. As far as our budget is concerned, which I know is the focus of today's hearing, our Board of Directors has begun the process of developing a revised three-year financial plan and preliminary fiscal year 2018 budget. The Board's Finance Work Group will offer a proposed budget and three-year financial plan at our March Board meeting, and then, once approved, we'll submit it to the Legislature for statute on March 15th. A full final fiscal year 2018 budget will be approved and published this summer. Part of the process, which we will get into more, I think, is includes working closely with DHS to refine our cost allocation methodology, and more on that when we get to it. But as I've said before, and I'll say again, our board and executive leadership team is committed to operating within our means. Our expenditures will not exceed our revenues. Enrollment fluctuates throughout the year, but we're prudent in our projections and vigilant about the resources we expect will be available. So finally, as CEO right now, I am laser focused on the next 36 hours and continuing to enroll as many people, as many Minnesotans into coverage as possible. You know, we take that job seriously. Our staff is working night and day very hard on this, and for an extra week and doing some extra hours now. Right now, and I'm really proud of that effort. But I can assure you that all of us at MNsure are dedicated to serving Minnesota and tailoring our action to the unique needs of our state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to give a few starting remarks as well, and then we can turn into the budget discussion. Wanted to first discuss a little bit about the Executive Steering Committee for the METS system. This was a body that existed prior to last year but was put in initiative by Representative Zerwas as a public body. We have been meeting publicly since August, I believe, and doing all of the work outlined in the statute in terms of public meetings, streaming and posting our minutes and the tape of the meeting. We have two very active county representatives working with us now, Deborah Huskins from Hennepin County, Janet Kolakowski from Stearns County. We also released the first quarterly budget report. We'll talk a little bit more about that later when we get into the budget. We released our second one this month. That's a requirement under the law to show how we're tracking our spending through the course of the year. We also, I just wanted to share, and this is in your pack, but there's a document that looks like this that is IT accomplishments for the MET system over the course of the 2016 year. There were a number there that a lot of effort that went in 2016 in terms of development and improvement for the system. We know we have more to do. We're working now on setting the roadmap for 2017. You have a copy of how that looks now in your packet. We have identified the first half of the year, but are still working on the second half of the year. Two other quick updates. I believe Mr. Morocco from the department gave you an update on a couple of weeks ago. One is the renewals process. We, with our Minnesota Care Renewals, put a lot of focus into that process this year as we came into the end of 2016 and into 2017. We had problems last year. Some of those problems were on us in our business process. We wanted to fix those processes and have a smoother result this year. I think we were successful in that. We really focused on communication. Everyone who was up for renewal got five communications from us. We started in October, so we started earlier to give people more time to work with that information. And then we launched a visibility campaign in December, really for the final push to help individuals try to make that deadline by the first of the year to continue their coverage. We renewed over 64,000 cases, and we ended up closing about 23,000 on January 1st. We're continuing to work with some of those cases to reestablish coverage, and we're completely caught up on our work on that. We've also been continuing with the process to migrate cases from the Maxis legacy system to the MET system, working with the counties. This has also been going smoothly so far. Like a number of other processes, that what we've seen is that the first time we go around with people, they don't always respond, but with multiple communications, we are able to get people to respond, and over time, getting good response rate and continuity of coverage for people who are making that transition. Finally, Mr. Chair, I wanted to address an audit that we released yesterday. This was an audit from our internal audits division. This was one of the audits that we promised last year when the legislative auditor released their report on healthcare eligibility. And we said we would do audits and have our own internal audits do those audits to help us judge where we're making progress, where we need to continue to do work, and to help us do a better job of measuring the progress that we're making and identifying where we need to put more effort and set priorities for IT work. We chose the renewal period, not this last one, but the one from the previous year, so the end of 2015. We chose that period because we had had a number of issues, particularly in Minnesota Care, but also in MA. We thought it was important we try to learn from those problems to make corrections going forward. We asked our auditors to create an audit which identified clearly what the issue was that was driving errors so that we could fix those issues. This was one of the challenges we had. With the OLA's audit, it was really hard for us to figure out what the exact problems were that led to the errors. The findings of the audit, we had a 13.7% error rate for people who received coverage they should not have received, a 3% error rate on those who were in the wrong program or in the wrong funding source. We found additional deficiencies that didn't result in errors, but are certainly areas where we'd like to improve. Some of those in the system, many of them with worker-created errors. We had a sample of about 300, and that's not a large enough sample to do an extrapolation, but we think it's helpful for us to identify the problems that we need to be working on. These error rates are too high, and the deficiencies, we have too many of them. And so we're disappointed in the findings. This is actually higher than the PERM audit that we did last year and the findings we had there. It is lower than the error rates that were found in the OLA's audit. But we also knew we would identify some issues during this period. We did extend about 86,000 people from into coverage in January in 2016 because of the problems we were having with notices. We knew many of those people were not eligible for that coverage. Closed a number of them at the end of the month, but during that month, I'm sure we accumulated errors in this audit. The audit also helps us to identify the errors, and some of the pieces that were here that we have already done work on and made progress, over half of the errors were due to the MET's MMIS interface. This is an issue that we have talked a lot about in terms of our challenges with the system. We did put a fix into the interface in March of 2016. That has been greatly improved the transaction of data from METS to MMIS. We've had some continuing challenges. We continue to work on those. We also monitor them from the business side so that we can continue to make corrections where we are seeing problems. Notices were called out in the audit. That's an area we work on in every single release. We make improvements to notices. We really targeted the renewals notices over the last year. Unique ID functionality, which will really improve reducing duplicate cases, which has been one of the issues that we've been dealing with. And then clearly the premium issue, again, which for Minnesota Care, we switched our premiums over to the MMIS system in March of 2016. That was a problem called out in the audit, which of course is a previous time period. We have not had problems with the audit, with the premiums going forward. And then finally, the audit helps us identify where we can do better in training our workers, the county workers, where we can do better in terms of providing clear instruction about how to manage different issues within the system. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks. If there are questions, we could take them now, or we could move to talking about the budget issues.
Representative Lubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for appearing today. You had mentioned the duplicate data issue, which I think has kind of been chronic the whole time, but you had made a reference to a unique ID. Could you explain that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, I'll give a, or Mr. Sharon, Representative Lubin, I'll give a brief explanation, but I might have Mr. Peterson give him more of the technical explanation on it as well. One of the things that I want to identify is this: most of these duplicates that were found in our audit were actually deficiencies and not errors. So we had a process in place where to identify duplicates and ensure they won't provide duplicate coverage, because duplicate coverage means we're paying twice, and that's what we want to avoid. Only one of the 54 that our auditors found where there was a duplicate case was there actually a duplicate payment. So our business mitigation process was working at stopping the duplicate cases from resulting in duplicate payments. Of course, it's better just not to have duplicate cases, and so that's the functionality we put in this last year to help minimize and reduce the number of duplicate cases we have, and that's where I think Scott could probably explain what we did from an IT end.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, part of the fix that went in early this year around unique ID was to improve the matching language. So previously, if there were discrepancies in name like Bob and Robert and things like that, the system would fail that to a queue, and a duplicate would be created, essentially a prospect record, which is inherently in the system as a defect, but actually to prevent duplicates from being in the system. I think that the key problem that we have with Met's implementation currently is there's no merge functionality or the ability to go back in and be able to merge those cases. And so that's something that's on the roadmap that is upcoming. So what we did initially is kind of what we've done for other issues, stop the bleeding initially, create that logic that is more intensive to allow less to be created, and then continue to work on the remaining issue in the back end.
Representative Lubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that answer. So the duplicate data has been, I'm an insurance guy, but I'm not healthcare, but I play one in TV. No, I don't. But anyway, the duplicate data has been around a long time. So what information? So they aren't getting any additional information now than that they weren't getting before to identify. So I apply, and I put in all of my data, and one time it goes in as Robert, one time it goes in as Bob. So the first name was the trip point before on who had identified who I was, because there's like a couple different ways I can come in to measure, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moon, there's multiple different, that was just one example, Robert and Bob. It could be a discrepancy in the way you entered the Social Security number the second time, any difference in those key matching elements.
So it could be the same Social Security number, but they would view it different if I left the dashes out or something.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation. I'm not a big Minshew supporter, you probably know that. But the question I have is, the first question is, the last figure I heard, what we have spent so far through Minshew is $400 million. Is that accurate yet, or is it quite a bit higher than that? Whoever wants to take that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I can speak from a systems perspective on what we've paid for development, staff augmentation, and the systems essentially at Remnant. As of the end of 12/31 of 16, it's about $270 million.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you. So the $400 million figure, does that include other expenditures besides?
Mr. Peterson.
So could anybody speak to that?
You want Terry to speak to that, or do you want? No. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, I can only speak to the system side of this, which is the $270 million. The $400 million, I'm not sure where that, how that relates to other expenditures within Insurer DHS.
Ms. Chair, she seems like she wants to speak to that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, I can provide a piece of it. We have received $189 million in federal grant funds.
Okay.
If that gives you a better picture.
On top of that?
No. That's included.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
When Scott, Mr. Leitz was CEO, one of the things I brought up at this committee was that, why are we paying these companies to fix something and then repay them to fix it again and again and again, okay? And I didn't get a real clear answer, so Scott came up to my, or Mr. Leitz came up to my office about a week, 10 days later. And he stated, you probably still can get a hold of him, hopefully, if you want to verify this, that the RFPs were not written up correctly, okay, in terms of making sure companies actually fix the problems that were created when they did the tech work. And so we had to repay them and repay them and repay them, millions of dollars. And those were his words. I also have a close friend who's a computer programmer, and he's worked with the large banks in the metro area. He's an independent contractor. He's retired now. But he has also worked with the state of Minnesota, and I ran that problem past him. And he said that in his dealings with the state of Minnesota on RFPs for technology, he didn't really think they knew what they were doing. Okay? Those are his words, not mine. So my question is, has this been addressed in a way so that we just don't keep repaying these companies over and over and over again when what they do doesn't work and needs to be fixed? I'd appreciate it if you'd speak to that, and it's by Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, there's been a lot of changes since 2013 and since this started. And minutes engagement initially was around infrastructure and things like that. As we've assumed responsibility for the contracting, there's been a lot of changes to the contracts. There's a team dedicated to just contracts at minute that deal with strictly technology issues. I think, if you recall, last year at this committee, we discussed the 17-point plan that we had in place for one of the vendors at the time in terms of making sure that quality was delivered, the product was delivered on time, that the code was delivered in a manner that was useful for the business, and we didn't have these issues. Since the roadmap of last year, which was largely completed, the timelines were met, the things that were set out in the contract were met to the satisfaction of what was requested for deliverables within them.
One more question.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Okay. Thank you for that. So I'm going to assume that that was a yes, that things are corrected.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Albrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And feel free to answer this in terms of who knows wants to feel it, but I'm going to talk about the Maxis conversion. At your January meeting of the Minister Board, it still identified over 250,000 MA enrollees on the legacy systems. Now, granted, that's down from your meeting of September, but I have, I guess, two questions on the Maxis system. When will they be enrolled on Minsure or through Minsure? And candidly, when was the most recent date that Maxis or the MMIS population had an eligibility termination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the conversion of cases from Maxis to Mets is over a year-long period. We're doing a chunk of them every month. So it's through September of 2017. That's when we'll be complete with converting over those cases. We had about 260 at the last count that we had lined up for conversion. We had already converted, had sent for conversion about 78,000 of those, and we're working on them as we go through each month. With the counties on converting them. And Mr. Representative Albright, I'm sorry I didn't catch the last part of your question.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking for when was that census last authenticated for an eligibility documentation?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright, the cases in Maxis are renewed on an annual basis and have been as they've been on that system. So the cases that we're actually converting, we're converting them on the renewal schedule. So instead of having them renew in Maxis, we're essentially having them renew by transferring over to the MET system. So they've been having the annual renewal as other cases in Maxis do.
Mr. Chair, and on the Maxis system itself, that is going away, and so there's no longer technical support to that. So when will the Maxis system no longer be provided technical assistance?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the Maxis system going away is a longer-term proposition. Maxis supports not just the population we're talking about, but also medical assistance eligibility for seniors and people with disabilities, and eligibility for all of our cash programs like MFIP and general assistance, as well as the SNAP program, foster care eligibility. There's a number of programs on the Maxis system. So as far as Maxis being done, doing eligibility for individuals who have what we call the MAGI eligibility basis under MA, that will largely be done in September, but we may continue to use the system for some populations if we're having difficulty with them on the Maxis system. There are a few particular kinds of situations that we continue to put onto Maxis in order to ensure that we can manage them properly.
Mr. Chair, and this question might be going to Ms. O'Toole, but you mentioned about sending out the 1099s. The 1095-A's. In your January 19th meeting, you said that there were 7,600 unprocessed QLEs. And I'm just wondering how that's possible to send out 1095-A's if you have unprocessed QLEs still sitting in queue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, thanks for the question. We have worked really hard to get those life events numbers down. Those are for 2017 coverage, most of them, and so they shouldn't have an impact on the 1095-A's that we're sending right now are for the 2016 coverage.
Mr. Chair, so Ms. O'Toole, to follow up on that, how long is the average wait for a QLE to be processed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I'll have to come back. I don't know the average right now. I will tell you that we have, during our busiest time, which is open enrollment, we have received a spike in life event changes. While we encourage consumers all year round to report those when they happen, they wait and do that during open enrollment. So we were in December a little bit backed up. We've been working really hard to get those back down to a good level. So I don't have, but I will follow up with you on an average time. I don't have that at my fingertips.
And just a final question, Mr. Chair. In terms of that backlog being resolved, do you have an action plan in place, or are you, not to be trying to placate us with, we're going to try harder type attitude?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I would not try and placate you. I don't know that I could. But we have we've had an action plan for this entire open enrollment period, and we are working day and night on these. When our call volumes get lower on the weekends, we work on them. And then right after, we've got 36 hours left in the special enrollment period. After that, we are going to be working overtime to make sure we get through that backlog as quickly as we can. So every day we'll have overtime.
So Ms. O'Toole, would it be fair to say that some that have requested a QLE might presume that they have insurance when they yet don't? for their qualifying life event beneficiary change?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the majority of the life events that we have are really just income changes, and so that wouldn't impact their coverage.
All right. Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you had talked about, and I don't know whoever wants to take this call, the heavy call volume times, and when that occurred right out of the blocks, Minshew came out and contended there was a robocall issue. And what was that looked into? How did that end up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunan, so Minute Services took that, and we're not an investigative agency, but we did the IT forensics on it, the security team. We did that, and then we turned that over to a local law enforcement agency, and after that it's beyond our scope of investigation.
So at this point we don't know?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lunan.
What are other entities, other call centers? I checked around. I have Amazon in my district, for instance, and the robocall issue is an issue there, and they, you know, put processes into place to deal with that, to remedy that. Do you know what other entities are doing to address or handle robocalls?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Luna, this isn't my area of expertise, but I'm happy to tell you that there were a group of individuals that met with both local experts as well as the national teams to discuss remedies that put in place. There were things put in place to rectify that this would not happen. It was again at least this type of situation.
I have one more question. I can wait until others go.
No. Just follow up on that. I believe at the time that there was specific allegations from the administration that this was perpetrated by political organizations. Do you have any evidence that that is in fact the case?
Mr. Chair, all we were working with is the data that we received. So we found anomalies in the data in terms of the numbers that we're calling. We turned that over to law enforcement. We have no way of knowing where or who those were coming from.
All right. So on the, we also have from the Office of Inspector General a report, public summary, information technology control weaknesses found at Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, and found specific vulnerabilities and made recommendations, finding that that there was not proper security with IT within the organization, and made specific recommendations. Could you tell me what changes have been made as a result of that?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information with me right now. We definitely can provide it. We did extensive work in this on this audit. I can get you those details.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I appreciate that. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to make a comment that, you know, the rate jump that happened in the individual market, Minshew is a website and actually isn't the big culprit in that. There's cost to Minshew that get thrown in there. But there are other big factors that I hope when we take a look at the reform phase, which we are now in some of this, that we look at the valid factors in what's affecting our rates, or actually more importantly, what's not affecting our rates, not putting a downward pressure on the cost of health care. So I wanted to make that comment first of all. But the question I have is, when we did have to deal with the rebates, and I think all the legislators around the table here, both sides of the aisle, had a frustration that we had to put so much taxpayer money that we could have used somewhere else into addressing that issue. And again, I'm not saying that it was Minshew's problem. However, the question I have is the fact that we weren't able to utilize the Minshew mechanism to distribute those refunds. And to this day, I don't understand. It seems like you're gathering all the data we need to distribute those. It should have been just a matter of plugging it in. And why wouldn't that have worked?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunan, part of the issue is that we don't have the entire population. We only have a subset of that population that is going through and enrolling in Minshew. The plan plan still have the availability of a consumer to come and shop within their site, and Insure has no availability to that data. So it was just a subset that was within Insure.
It seems to me anyone had access to go on to Insure if they were applying for that refund, and a lot of the question would have already been on a form you have of saying, okay, here's my data, and could have been processed that way. It seems like that would have been the logical doorway to do this through. Anyone, whether I'm going to go through Insure or not, I'm allowed to fill out an application, correct?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Just in terms of where we are updating, as before we go into budgeting, one of the things that's going to be very important in looking forward into budget is basically a drop-dead date on development, where we go to zero money for development in budget. And so one of the things that's going to be important to figure out is if we're done. Looking again at the GAO's report from last year, Minnesota in four metrics on development was not completely built out in any of the four: eligibility, enrollment, financial management, hub service, IRS reporting and submissions. In all of those metrics, they could be scored as either substantially complete, partially complete, or incomplete, and we were incomplete or substantially incomplete in all of those metrics. And so we're very concerned about moving forward with a budget with zero IT development if, in fact, we are not done with that, we're not fully operational. Can you give us an update about if this were to be recalculated today, what would the GAO say about where you are?
Mr. Chair, I think I'd have to look at the specifics of the GAO and refresh myself on that. I know that, from the minute perspective, we're very focused on delivering the core functionality that the business units prioritize and ask for. And so that's been our focus for the last 2 years, and we've delivered on those. So going back, we could definitely go back and refill that form out for you, showing where we've made progress in those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And again, we're not going to be able to ask for any more money to do that. So we want to make sure that we are there. And also, before we move on to budget, one of the unresolved things from the, from OIG, Minnesota Marketplace misallocated federal funds and claimed unallowable costs. There are several recommendations, one of which was to give back $346,000 for the establishment grants. One was to give back $933,000 to CMS and other paybacks that were due back to CMS. Could you just give me an update on the resolution about those pieces from the November 16 report?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to, and I will also check with our legal counsel to see if they have any update. But those, an audit from the OIG is a recommendation to CMS, and they have not asked to recover those funds. I will make sure that we have not had communication with them in the last week.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a couple follow-up things. One, I had a staff member just brief me quickly. That $400 million figure came from a DHS memo, I guess, and it did not include any tax credits. That's just total expenditure, whether it's federal, state, or whatever. So that's where that came from. Second thing is, since I sell health insurance, I've been miserable ever since the Obamacare was passed, to tell you the truth. and I will say this past time, I haven't had as many complaints as I had other years. That's because they got less customers. Most of them have gone someplace else. On medical assistance, Minnesota Care, whatever. But, you know, one of the areas of complaints is in the area of self-service. In other words, adding or subtracting a dependent, that they have to continue to go through the call center. They claim they're waiting hours or calling back or, you know, being told, put on hold, and nobody comes back and gives them an answer. You know, these are the types of complaints I've had. Is there any plans to create some self-service for existing people so they can make some of these changes of removing a dependent or adding a dependent or things such as that? Probably technology question.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reagan, that is one of the things that is on the list that business is prioritizing.
So the answer is it's coming soon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I mean, the priority process works through from an IT perspective. The availability is there if we put resources and time to do it. I think it depends on the business side. If other things are more pressing, like the MMS interface and things, other things that we're working on.
So, Mr. Chair, I assume the answer is you're not quite sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the roadmap for 2017 is not complete yet, so I would say I'm not sure, yes.
All right. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. O'Toole, I just wanted to follow back on the conversation you and I had about QLEs. And you wrote a letter to the board on January 18th where you cited the aging of the QLEs as well as the life event subjects that were pertained to those. And in all total, there were 7,700 QLAs that had not been processed as of January 18th, many of which the subjects or the categories that those fell into would inherently have affected the outcome and the information on 1095A. So when the comment is made that those have been completed, or at the very best, you still have a certain number of thousand outstanding, I'm wondering if we're getting mixed messages here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think I wonder if it's just miscommunication between the two of us. The 1095As, so let me just give it a shot here. The 1095As that were just sent out are for the coverage year 2016. What the life event changes are impacting the 2017 coverage. So those 1095As will be sent out a year from now. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
And I certainly understand that. But when you have almost 1,800 of those QLEs sitting out in queue that are over 90 days old, how can we determine that the ones that have been processed are the oldest ones first as opposed to the newest ones? And this, if I'm reckoning this right, the letter that you wrote to the board on the 18th of January is talking about 6,300 QLEs that are older than 30 days old. And so to process those with such things as tax filer status change, gained a minimum essential coverage, added a household member, removed a household member, birth of a child, those are all applicable to the qualification standard. And so I'm pressing you to understand how that success rate for 1095As is quantifiable when in your letter it doesn't seem like that's a correct and true statement.
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I think I'm happy to sit down with you with the folks that are working on this. We can walk through it if that would help. After this hearing, we can follow up.
Mr. Chair, and I think, you know, just because of the significance of this, I don't think that it's not just warranted for me personally, but I think that should be shared with the committee as a whole.
I'm happy to do that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I share your priority on maximizing our federal funds when we can on this development. I think we're getting a 90% federal match, which has been very helpful in terms of updating our systems. But I was a little concerned when you talked about a drop-dead date on development, and I'm hoping that actually the plan is for a system that will be continuous improvement over time, because part of the difficulty that we've had and that counties have had and that users have had is that we're trying to get a system that was designed in 1980 with 1980 computer software with a minor update in the 1990s to suddenly get to 2017. And that has been an unfair investment for our counties, for the people that we serve who are applying to these programs, to our property tax base, to all kinds of things that we, over all those years, prioritized other investments rather than keeping up our computer systems. And I'm hoping that while this has been a big hurdle to kind of leap the generations, I'm hoping that we as a committee will learn from that and continue to invest over time and keeping up with changes in technology and continuing to have a system that's usable and cost efficient both at the state and the local level. And I don't disagree that probably wasn't your intention, but I just thought I'm hoping that there's, in addition to these short-term plans, which we have to do, that we're also seeing some joint effort on kind of a long-term maintenance and partnership through the executive committee that Representative Zerwas brought the counties in and others in. And, you know, maybe you could tell us whether or not you're starting to look at that. How do we keep the system up over time?
And Representative Loeffler, I think I was referring to their budget that we're going to be looking at, which is, in fact, a development budget of zero in 18, and that's whether or not you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, that's what the number is, and it's basically because the federal funds are gone. But I think we'll probably go through that more as they're laying out their budget. I think that's probably something that we should address in the pace of looking at the budget for 17-18. One of the questions that I had just been talking about life events from 16 going into 17, you know, if somebody becomes pregnant, they call in a contact insurer in some way, shape, or form, and it's very important to get an updated status. But that would be a 2016 event that would have implications in 16, obviously, and 17. So in something like that, it is very time sensitive, and it matters in terms of reimbursement to providers. It matters in terms of care, lots of other ways. So on the one end, not getting that uploaded quickly in real time is a big deal. For, you know, 40 weeks of gestation is 40 weeks. On the other hand, I've heard anecdotally that we've got people that are pregnant for 24 months. And I know that's not the case, and I'm glad, but that's what the status is. So can you talk a little bit about that in terms of real life care, real life coverage, and the necessity to get that up, and how that actually impacts people?
Mr. Chair, thanks for that question. I, you know, we have an expedited process through which we handle more urgent cases, like you're mentioning, if someone's going to add a baby or things like that. So we do have a process in place that we can handle things more immediately.
And have you processed complaints or had complaints that is not in fact happening?
You know, Representative Dean, I don't have particular knowledge of a certain complaint. I'm happy to follow up if you have specifics of something.
All right, thank you. Representative Hamilton moves the minutes from February 2nd, 2017.
So
any
moved.
Additions, subtractions, corrections? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The February 2nd minutes are adopted, and Representative Hamilton has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to share with you, at 1:34, so about 10 minutes ago, I received a text message. They were listening to the debate, and they wanted to share their story. When open enrollment came around, they both got on the phone very early, because they're going to do so, right, beat the rush. They called in at 6 a.m. Amber was on hold from 6 a.m. until 4:45 p.m., and nobody picked up the phone. Deb was on the phone from 6 a.m., well, the same amount of time. They just kept it on hold all day long while they're working and whatnot, keeping their phone on. The following day, they both called in at 6 a.m. Amber's was received at, Deb's was received at 12:30 that day, and then Amber's was received at 3:30 p.m., and when she finally got on, to top it all off, once she finally got on, they only had limited plans left to choose from, none of which were affordable for them. These are real-life things that are taking place and real-life people that experience this. And, again, has this been addressed, and will this be corrected and limited, eliminated?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I am happy to follow up with any of those consumers should they have issues. I'm not aware. You know, we don't open our phone lines at 6 o'clock, so I don't know where they were on hold with, but I am happy to follow up with those specific issues right after the hearing.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair and panelists. I just want to reiterate the concern that Representative Albright and Representative Dean talked about related to qualifying life events. That is the most common complaint I received in talking to constituents. And I would love to be able to go back and tell them they do not have to be stressed about not knowing if their baby has health coverage or their new spouse has health coverage or a member of their family. So it is absolutely a number one concern. I wanted to make sure that was clear. Second, two things. When you talked about training and making the process more efficient for counties, what my county tells me is that to enroll someone takes 3 days. They're aligning their staff and their budget time. They've had to take staff from other important resources in the county to apply to this process. What can the expectation be for 2017-2018 as far as the number of the amount of hours it takes to enroll somebody?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haley, I haven't heard of 3 day before, so I'm not sure particularly what the county was dealing with related to that. I think there's a couple of issues that we're trying to address from a county perspective, and I think folks know the county's been working very actively with us and have an interest in trying to accelerate the work that we're able to do on the system as well. One is with the MMS interface that I talked about earlier. That's definitely a place that has bogged down a lot of cases and sometimes results in the county having to wait for something to be corrected or for the interface to actually go through, which can then take additional time and add to the case time. And it affects their customer service because they're in a position where they're not able to communicate to the enrollee about whether they're eligible or not and so forth. We have also worked, as we mentioned earlier, on the duplicate cases, and that's a place that has also generated some time for counties, and the merging of those cases, which is on the list for something to do in 2017, will help to avoid a lot of the work for counties. There are also just a lot of smaller individual issues where counties have some kind of a workaround or some way in which they need to have special instructions for how to use the system that I know take them a lot of time because they don't necessarily do them very often. And there's a lot of those instructions they have to go through to find the right one to be able to take action on it. A lot of those are related to defects, and one of the things that we're trying to do in 2017 is go back and clean up a lot of the defects. We've been focused on kind of some of these bigger pieces of functionality, but not always cleaning up some of those smaller issues that are still left in the system. And so looking at those that have the biggest impact on workload, I know is one of the things that the counties are bringing into our governance conversations is, hey, these are the ones that are really costing us time. Can we put those first on the list? So those are some of the key issues that I think we'd be working on with counties. I'd also have one of the issues that we don't talk about a lot, and I know counties have been working a lot in terms of messaging around the system, and I know they share this as well. We have about almost 50% increase in our medical assistance caseload since we moved into the Affordable Care Act. So counties are just dealing with a lot more cases on top of having some challenges in the system. There are some things where the system has helped to relieve them of work. There's, I don't know the exact percentage, but there's something probably around a quarter of individuals who are able to apply online and go through cleanly, and counties never have to touch those. Our auto-renew rate for renewal cases is now up into the 35% range. So that means that counties don't need to touch about 35% of the renewal cases because they're auto-renewing through the system. Those are the kinds of things that would make counties' lives a lot easier, is to have more people be able to transact without having to have an intervention by the county worker. And that also goes back to the self-service issue that was raised earlier.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair. One quick follow-up. What is the average time it should take a county to enroll somebody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. It kind of depends on the case, but I could go back and see. So at DHS, we actually do the county casework role, the casework role for the Minnesota Care Program, and I could get an estimate from our folks on how long it takes them to take a case and then get some sense of that range of what are the ones that may take longer versus which ones are pretty quick and easy to move through.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Haley. And I know Representative Schultz and I were just in St. Louis County, and that was one of the things that we talked about was the time it takes to make changes, individual changes, from where they were to where they are now and how that's improving. And I think they might have a very accurate information for you on exactly what the differences in time is. Would encourage you to contact Wabasha and which one?
Goodhue.
Wabasha and Goodhue counties, and they will give you a lot of good information. Representative Hamilton.
Oh, just a clarification. They started calling at 6, and then when their phone was taken, it was the very first day of eligibility or open enrollment. And then once it was taken, they're on hold all day long until they finally hung up at 4:30. And I'll give you the name and number. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Hey, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Peterson, this goes to the IT security issue. I know a number of people have vetted this, that over the last couple of years, Minsure has used both Facebook and Twitter to triage some of the overflow to handle the call center. It seems to me that would be a bit of a crisis in terms of data security. I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the Minsure business process to use Facebook and Twitter is just the initial connection. There should be a contact after that via the phone, meaning nothing, no private information being shared in those venues.
Mr. Chair, and so Mr. Peterson, the assurance from you is that there is no private information being shared through a DM or other means on those two social media websites?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, what we do is provide the information and the security assessments necessary, provide business with essentially rules to follow. It's not that we are in a position to monitor Twitter or that traffic. So the expectation is that they, not only with this, but just other in general practice, the business entities that we're working with are following the security protocols.
So Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, how would you go about auditing that your own employees are following that protocol?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have several checks in place for internal permitted employees in terms of tools and things that monitor access to data, things like that. There's routine audits in terms of ensuring that employees actually should be audited, accessing that data and things like that, more from an administrative level.
And Mr. Chair, one final question. Is that under the purview of the OLA or the audit perspective provided to the Minsure Board that type of audit and security is being reviewed on a regular basis, quarterly, if not more frequently?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I would assume so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We're going to go to Representative Lunan, and then I think we need to move into the budget and save other questions for after we can walk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question has to do with Representative Haley's comment. I, too, am in Scott County, and when I went down and talked to the navigators, it was not uncommon to have it take more than a day to get a MNCHR application. But one of the things that one of the people had said to me that I thought was important is there was a concern they had as to the qualification for advising people for insurance, what coverage they get. And I coupled that with comments from providers about unpaid for care, that people come in and they have an absolutely unfathomable deductible based on their income situation. When they came in, it's kind of the equivalent to naming your own price in health care. What training do the navigators get? I'm a licensed insurance agent, and we have in statute what's called the suitability clause. If I sell you insurance and it is not deemed to be reasonably suitable to what your needs are, you're allowed to revoke my errors and omissions coverage. So the navigators, what training do they have as far as advising people on what is appropriate coverage to get?
Yes, sir, too.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lulian, navigators, unlike brokers, cannot advise people on what to choose. They are helping people navigate and give them facts. But I can give you, we do extensive training with navigators every year. I am happy to provide you with either a summary or all of that material as necessary. We're happy to provide that. But they are different roles than a broker.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, there's nobody advising these people as to what is an appropriate level of risk for them to take on their health care based on their circumstances. Sounds like that's it.
So cool.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunan, I don't know who they are getting advice for, but navigators cannot advise people. That's the broker's role.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed with the budget sheets that you have.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm going to orient you to this sheet that you should have in your packet. It says MNCHR DHS interagency agreements at the top of it, and then there's a bunch of small print. Finding it. Mr. Chair, one of the things that we thought it was important to cover is the interagency agreement that exists between MNCHR and DHS. We have a very complex arrangement for how money flows between DHS, MNCHR, and MNIT to support the health care the current status of health care as we delivered in Minnesota. So what this sheet shows you is three separate categories within the interagency agreement, and we're going to walk through each of these and then allow you to focus your questions around those as we get to them. So the first one that's at the top, this is a part of the interagency agreement that we at DHS bill MNCHR for certain services that MNCHR has asked us to perform on their behalf. There's no legal requirement around this, but it is essentially, and you can see the list there in the smaller bullets, functions that MNCHR as an agency has asked us to deliver for them because they believe that we can do it more effectively given the scope and size of DHS. So human resources, payroll, procurement, you see a list of different items there. We've negotiated these in different ways. Some of them have a metric or some kind of a per item payment that's associated with them, such as how we handle receipts in the receipt center. Some of them are just a chunk of money. So essentially in human resources, for example, MNCHR pays us $200,000 a year. It's roughly two FTEs. That's our collective estimate of how much HR support we provide to MNCHR. You can also see that through quarter 30th of 2016, there have been about $6.2 million billed under here. I believe we have some additional invoices in your packet on some of the more recent charges on this part of the invoice as well. So, Mr. Chair, this is about the most straightforward piece of the arrangement, and I'd stop there in the event there are any questions around that part of it.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the next section of the interagency agreement is really what is called MNCHR business.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Before you move on to that, Representative Franson has a question.
Of
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, so I'm just kind of looking at the DHS support service costs, and I see that DHS bills mature, which you were kind of chatting about there. Could you just give the body exactly what those rates per hour is, who determines those rates, or where we can find them?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and our representative, they are in the interagency agreement, which I think you have in front of you. I'm getting a nod from Holly. It's the fifth document, which has many amendments to it as well. We're actually in the process of reviewing the interagency agreement for FY18 to kind of consolidate all the amendments into the main body and address those. If you page through those, you'll see each of the items that are on this sheet addressed and the consideration for payment laid out. As I said, those are generally agreed upon as the nature of an agreement. MNCHR and DHS agrees upon what the appropriate level of payment is for those different services, based either on some per unit charges on a few of the items, or sometimes just a chunk of money that represents our collective best estimate of how much we believe MNCHR will consume of our services, based on past experience or expected future experience.
And if you have any page within the thick packet, if you could refer Representative Franz into whichever page, if they are, I don't know if they have like a master number that we stamped on them or not. No.
Mr. Chair, when I page through it, I kind of see each of these categorized in the nature of the agreement laid out for each of them, okay, which shows a consideration for the payment at the end of each section. Mr. Chair,
I think we can probably circle back to that, Commissioner Johnson. But first, just so members maybe have a little bit of a background on this issue and kind of why this is a big deal. When MNCHR was created, it is different from other agencies because it is independent both in governance and in funding sources. So it is something that the legislature created, but yet does not have direct oversight, doesn't directly oversee. So that caused a lot of issues when it was initially being passed. And in the last cycle, 2 years ago, we were very apprehensive, and before that, I personally was very apprehensive about money going from an agency over which we do have control to an agency that we don't have control over, and that being without our authority. So that MNCHR can bill DHS for stuff and get paid for that without us appropriating the money. And that's a big threshold to cross, and it's one that I think that the administration exceeded its authority in doing. And I was very clear about it then, and I'll be clear about it now, that I think that we do have oversight over both of these that we should exercise as a committee. And so that's why I think it's very important to understand, do you or do you not have the statutory authority to access funds within DHS? And then number two, if we do believe that they do not have the statutory authority, what are we going to do about that? And then moving forward, how do we forecast how much money this is going to cost? If we have to pay 70% of whatever, we should know what that whatever is if we're going to be billed for that. And also, just from an executive standpoint, if we have a governor that doesn't like the budget he or she establishes, is it appropriate or inappropriate to just have one agency bill another for that which you don't get appropriated through the legislature? So that's why I think that this is an important thing for the committee to focus on, because these are very large dollar amounts, and it's something that we decided not to delineate statutorily. So that's kind of my own personal investment in this, and it's something that I appreciate you coming forward with a delineation of the agreements today.
And Mr. Chair, and for Representative Franson, there's a table that's after page 19. It's called page 1, but it's after page 19 in the IAA. That's kind of, it's a summary of each of those items as whether they're fixed or variable and how they're paid. I think that's from the original agreement, so it would have been affected by some of the subsequent amendments, but it gives you a good general idea. So, Mr. Chair, transitioning to the second topic, which is MNSHR business operations, this is the cost and the budget of supporting the operations of the MNSHR organization. Just to, and to your point, Mr. Chair, you have another page within your packets called History of Appropriations Tracking to Department of Human Services, and it looks like a page you'd find in your budget book. I'm not going to go through this page in detail, but what it shows you is the appropriations that were made to DHS in 2013 and 2015 for support of the next two items we're going to talk about, both the MNSHR business operations and the METS IT system, where we share responsibility for financing the system with MNSHR. So on this topic, I'm going to turn over to Ms. O'Toole and Ms. Coob to walk you through the MNSHR budget, business operations budget.
So, Mr. Chair, I am here with our CFO, Carrie Kolb, who has not appeared before this committee before, I don't believe, but she will walk through at a high level our budget, and then we are happy to answer any questions.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Kolb, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Carrie Kolb. I am the CFO at MNSHR. The document that I'm going to review is what was approved on the July 20th board meeting at MNSHR. It was the fiscal year 2017 proposed budget, and what it shows at the top of the document is our resources, and it comes from three locations. Our premium withhold revenue of 3.5% of the premiums that are charged in MNSHR. It also comes from our federal SSIO establishment grants, and it comes from the DHS reimbursement for our business operations. Together, those three sources make up the resources that MNSHR operates from. The latter half, or the lower half of the budget document that you'll see, is the categories of spending that MNSHR has budgeted for fiscal year 2017. And it is separated between administration, regulatory, communications, customer service, and the METS IT system. Some of these categories are 100% funded with premium withhold revenues. Some of them are shared with the cost allocation with DHS through the public assistance cost allocation plan, which is short and abbreviated for PACAP. And that is submitted to CMS and SSIO, and then the third thing is our establishment grants, and that is funding some of our expenditures on the bottom line. For example, the METS IT system development for fiscal year 17, the proposed budget was $6.2 million, and that was 100% federal funding. With this understanding that this was passed on July 20th, we then had the end of the fiscal year. The hard close was August 12th, and we did not have all of the data that we had at the end of the fiscal year included in this document because of the time passing. So we are going to be updating our three-year budget to reflect those resources continuing into fiscal year 18, with the understanding that the federal funding does end at the end of December 31st this year.
Thank you. All right. And I had a question, Ms. Kolb. One of the things that I reached out to MMB and asked for the statutory authority to bill DHS directly for this, and there is vague, a little bit blurry authority within 256.014 which allows the Commissioner of Human Services to establish and enhance computer systems necessary for the operation of medical assistance. DHS has then expanded its understanding to include that this may be used for the investment of the development of miniature technology systems. I guess I would disagree with that. That was asked for and rejected in the budget 2 years ago. But however, it was interpreted to do that. And I'm just wondering if there is a policy change or if there's a clarification within this that would say that that's, in fact, what we're going to do. And are there any guardrails up to protect taxpayers from any upper limit of expenditures from MNsure outside of that which we as a legislature appropriate?
Yeah, if we could, Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson will attempt to answer.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd say two things. One is that I believe there is, well, I know there is, I'm not sure the exact site, explicit authority within the MNsure statute for the board. It says the board must develop an interagency agreement with the Commissioner of Human Services for the purposes of cost allocation. I think it's a 6205B something. I believe that's the authority that actually governs this particular piece we're talking about now, which is not about IT systems. It's actually about the MNsure business operations, the salaries and the lease and the other things that are relevant to the operations of their organization. To your question about whether there's an upper limit, we have within our authority some ability to move money around within our administrative accounts. And we have some authority to enter into interagency agreements with other agencies. So that does open the ability to do additional funding beyond what might have been anticipated by the legislature initially. We have not done that in this case. All the funds we have used have been within the dollars that were appropriated for the purpose of supporting MNsure and the Affordable Care Act.
And Mr. Johnson, correct me if I'm wrong, but the majority of the money that MNsure gets is from DHS, isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, I defer to Ms. Kolb on that.
And I would say no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The majority does not come from DHS. I would say approximately 45%, but I would have to verify that number. I believe it's about 45% of our budget for fiscal year 18 is going to be 17 is coming from DHS. About 20% of that is state funding, and 25% of that is federal funding. And to that point about the limitations, I also want to make sure everybody is aware that we are not allowed to spend beyond what that pay cap cost allocation methodology has put in place. So if, for example, we have a methodology that says half of a specific charge is going to be paid for with our premium withhold and the other half would be paid for with DHS, there are limitations then to what we could actually spend. So there are built-in or inherent limitations to our spending.
And I would just point out, Ms. Kolb, that throughout the history of this, when we had the Gruber-Gorman report and we challenged the where those numbers were actually going to come down, we were assumed that those were going to be sufficient, and we never anticipated that half, more than half, or even near half of the money that would be flowing to MNsure would come through DHS and our public programs through attribution. And I can remember I was sitting right where Representative Johnson was sitting, and Ms. Nalmov was sitting at that table when they asked for the authority to go up to 3.5% on the premiums, saying that they would never, ever need to go that high, even if enrollment was lower than expected. And lo and behold, not only did it go to 3.5%, but now we're having to build DHS on top of that as well. So that's why we're very leery of future projections within this, and why we are very protective of DHS budgets that can and should be going for things like taking care of people who need a lot of extra help. So with that, please continue. I'm sorry, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to follow up the figure that about 45% of the MNCHR funding comes from DHS. So maybe, Ms. O'Toole, can you tell us approximately what percentage of the service that is given by MNCHR, what percentage of the enrollments or however you were, the time on the phone or any of that, is going for not people in the individual market, but people who are actually enrolling into our public programs? Could you give us that figure?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, thank you for that question. The majority of enrollments that are coming through MNCHR right now are for public programs. So we are currently, I think I mentioned just very briefly in my opening statement, that we are looking to refine our cost allocation agreement with DHS to make sure we are using updated metrics, but you are correct. The majority of enrollments are for public program enrollees.
So, Mr. Chair, you know, I think it's, I'm sure for anybody watching, this would be horribly confusing. It's pretty confusing for committee members, but the fact is that MNCHR is kind of, is the door, the one door, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, but this is how I understand it. It has been built and intended to be a one-door system for people to go in, some of whom will end up buying a private plan on the individual market and maybe eventually a small group plan, and some will go into public programs. And so this blending of the finances, if you will, that's so confusing for us is because it is serving these two functions. So to the chair's point, this is money that is helping people enroll in public programs. And if it isn't, then that's something I would be really concerned about, because that is the intention here, was that we were not just building an exchange for people to enroll in the individual market. We were trying also to upgrade and make our public program enrollment more functional and easier for people to manage. And I know we still have a ways to go on that, but, you know, I don't know how we could expect MNCHR to act as the doorway into public programs if we didn't fund that part. So I think that is some of what's going on here. I also just wanted to make a little comment, you know, on the issue about the 3.5% and how, you know, that's higher than we ever expected. I wonder if some of the GOP members would have been okay if it had been 2.5%. You know, I think that they were against it anyway because it was part of the ACA, part of Obamacare. And, you know, and I've said so many times, I don't love having an insurance system either. I think that there have been a lot of problems with that. But I think that we've seen, even though we had the very rough rollout and all that stuff, that we can't seem to stop talking about that. I think we are seeing some real progress here. And it's sure seems like, for all the continued rough spots, that we are still making progress in making this a more seamless way for people to get enrolled in health insurance. I would like to see a system where we don't need any of this. I would like to see a system where every Minnesotan is automatically enrolled in health insurance, gets health care by virtue of being a Minnesotan. But we're not there, so we have to do all these things that are really about figuring out who gets what and who pays what in health care. I think everyone should have health care, but while we're in this health insurance thing, I think that we need to keep in mind that we're trying to make sure that we maintain this sort of dual system. And that's what we're talking about here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And I did find that in the document that you handed out in the packets, MNCHR DHS interagency agreements, under business operations, it says based on the expenditures and cost allocations, approximately 60% of MNCHR's ongoing agency operations will be financed by DHS. Goes on to say DHS recovers 40% from the federal Medicaid program. So maybe we could follow up on that to talk a little bit about that. But that seems to about line up where my thought it was at coming into the meeting as well. And next up, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Mr. Chair, and for Ms. O'Toole or Commissioner, in your opening statements, you made reference to the fact that going forward, Minshew was going to be self-sustaining. Given what we see deliberated out in Washington now with 40% of your revenue to sustain Minshew at present levels, notwithstanding what might be happening in the future with reference to what Representative Liebling suggested, and I concur with some of her points, not all, but a few, only about the county programs being in control of more of the issue. It seems like there's a dichotomy that you've set up for yourself where you're reliant upon another entity for a majority, well, short of majority of the funding for your program, but that doesn't square with your intention to be self-sustaining. And I'm hoping that I can find an answer in what you respond.
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I will start, and if Chuck Johnson wants to add, I welcome that. You know, we do, in our three-year financial plan, our current three-year financial plan, FY18 shows a self-sustaining budget. That means without federal funds. Now, I know there's a lot of activity. We're certainly monitoring what's happening here at the state level and also the federal level. If major changes are made, we will have to adjust and adjust quickly for Minnesotans because they could be some big changes. You know, what you're, I think, referring to is Medicaid funding. And I'd ask Mr. Johnson for help here. But we'll adjust if we have to. And I think my focus as those changes come through will be to communicate with consumers so they know what to do and when to do it and how to do it. And we will work quickly with our partners to figure out what we need to do. But, you know, in terms of our premium withhold, that is certainly will continue the functions for the private plan enrollments. And if Mr. Johnson wants to talk to the Medicaid population, I'd welcome that.
Mr. Chair, a couple of things I think to reinforce what Representative Liebling brought up. Yes, we benefit directly by some of the functions that Minshew carries out, and those are the ones that we participate in, like the outreach to the community, the navigator function, the call center, which takes some of our calls, as well as arrangements that we have around communication. So I think that those are areas where, you know, that's the purpose of a cost allocation, is the federal government has to agree that public programs are benefiting in order to sign off on that plan. I would also say, Mr. Chair, that, you know, I brought up the 62V site because this was the way the legislature in 2013 decided to fund the Minshew business. And from our perspective, it wasn't a... It was largely about trying to leverage some of the federal Medicaid dollars by cost allocating and just understanding, as Representative Liebling said, there was a shared role here that made this a possible way to move forward, and that's what we've done. I might be jumping a little bit ahead where Ms. O'Toole is, but I'll also say that we are looking at the cost allocation. We've been through two fiscal years of having a cost allocation that was built on the metrics we had in place at the time and that we could identify. We're reconsidering that. My hope in our conversation so far would look like the DHS share is going to go down. To your point earlier, from our perspective, the DHS perspective, I'd rather be spending money on the IT needs that we have and not on the Minshew business side. And so if we can get an arrangement that allows us to come up with a lower cost allocation, that frees up some money for us to invest in IT improvements. That's the kind of conversation that we're having now as we go into fiscal year 18.
Thank you, Ms. Commissioner Johnson. And just from my own perspective, we don't think you should be subsidizing anything the legislature doesn't have authority over, whether it's a car dealership or whether it's Minshew. If it's outside of our purview and in authority, I think that's it's inappropriate and we should fix it. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of what my question was has been answered, but just in terms of addressing Minshew as the public offering public and private health care programs, when we had spent about $200 million on the Minshew business model, one of the Minshew board members, Tom Forsythe, was quoted in our local media as saying that this was madness, okay? Those were his words, not mine, and it was in quotes. I, by the way, can't find the articles now on the Internet. However, I did print a copy. So if you'd like to read it, I have it. Now, that's a Minshew board member, okay? I find myself increasingly in agreement with his conclusions based on the expenditures and the problems that are inherent in this system. But my question probably goes just a little bit further. If Obamacare is completely repealed at the federal level, and I think Minshew, my understanding is tied into the federal hub in a way that it can access tax records. So if it's completely repealed, that would mean you'd lose that ability. So what have you, you know, have you made any contingency plans? Because my prediction would be that they'd probably do a repeal and a replacement by January 1, 2018. Now, I know that's still in flux. But, you know, are you looking at any alternative models? What would happen to Minshew if it was completely repealed? And do you think you could find a job someplace else in state government? You don't have to answer the last question. Go ahead.
That's so cool.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunhagen, I appreciate your sense of humor. You know, I don't have a crystal ball about what's going to happen in Washington. We are certainly, and if anyone here does, I'd love to see it. We get varying reports every day, like I'm sure you do too. We are monitoring it closely, like any responsible organization would do, and we will act and adjust accordingly. You know, you are correct when you are referencing how we call it pinning the federal hub for, I think, nine different other federal agencies to get information. So you're right, and it just depends on what path they take. But what I know is that Minnesota has led on health reform for a long time. We're going to continue to do it, and we welcome the conversation as those changes take place on the federal level and anything that takes place here. I'm really proud of the progress we've made. You know, we're not perfect, but 96% of Minnesotans are now covered since the ACA was passed, and that's something we should all be proud of. That means our our state is healthier and our economy is stronger when people are covered.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Field, do you know the number of Minnesotans that have health insurance now, health coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, great question. The private plan enrollees and public plan combined is over 400,000 Minnesotans.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. O'Toole, if the Affordable Care Act is repealed at the federal level, have you made contingency plans for what's going to happen to those 400,000 Minnesotans?
Ms. O'Toole.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, I would, you know, again, I welcome any conversation. I view my role as, you know, needing to communicate with consumers about what's to come and as changes are made. But any big changes are going to impact 400,000 Minnesotans, and that's a big deal. I talk to consumers every day. They are nervous about it. And we are laser-focused, like I said, for the next 36 hours on getting as many Minnesotans as we can enrolled into coverage. And I'm happy to say that we've hit record enrollment this year, and many other states around the country have too. So, you know, we will carefully monitor these changes and stay in contact with Minnesota consumers.
Thank you. All right, anything to wrap up?
We
just have a couple minutes left. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, we didn't. I just wanted to quickly address the last piece on the page, which is the Mets systems cost. And I think that when we talk about DHS and Minshew and our intertwined fiscal, this is where DHS has the by far larger investment. If you look at the details there, we cover about 90% of the operating costs and about 79% of developed. I think those are FY16 numbers. And that's because 92% of the people who are in the MET system are on public programs. And so it's our responsibility as an agency that oversees those programs to provide the funding for that those services. If you look at the detailing we have in your packet, and I'm not going to try to go through it because of time crunch here, a report, this is the report that we presented from the Executive Steering Committee, has a couple of tables in it, and the table that's on the second page actually lays out the detail. I mean, the bulk of the money that is being spent is actually federal Medicaid money because of the high matching rates that we can achieve. With our expenditures, we're able to draw down a significant amount of Medicaid, federal money to help with the system development piece. The other piece that I think is confusing to people, and I've said this before, and I'm not sure it'll make it less so because it is kind of confusing, is we, DHS, pay Minute for the IT costs. Minute pays the vendors and their own staff and whoever else is involved in the development of the IT side of the work. We then, in turn, at DHS, bill Minsure for their share of those costs. Because we're the big kahuna in this in the IT side, we actually manage this through our systems fund, which allows us to be able to manage our federal reimbursement better, and it's easier for Minsure just to pay us than for us to try to split code everything. But ultimately, all the money is going to Minute, who is then, based on input from business, deciding what we're working on, which vendors we're contracting with, and so forth.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, and we do appreciate it, and we will be, I'm sure, crossing paths again as the budget moves its way through, both on the DHS side as well as on Minsure side. I do appreciate especially the homework ahead of time for the questions that we had given to you. We do appreciate that. With that, members, we are adjourned.